The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you, everyone. Good evening. I'd like to thank the Free Library for giving me the great privilege of spending an evening with one of the governors and my favorite writers. And it's my pleasure to introduce him this evening, one of America's most distinguished writers, historians, narrators, and lecturers. A native of Pittsburgh with a degree in English literature from Yale University, David McCullough spent the first 12 years of his career as an editor and writer for Sports Illustrated, the United States Information Agency, and American Heritage. It was during that time that he found a story that he thought was exciting and worth telling. The resulting book, The Johnstown Flood, was a critical success, and for readers, the first of nine powerful encounters with American history at the hand of David McCullough. Mr. McCullough has twice earned the Pulitzer Prize for his unparalleled biographies of John Adams and Harry Truman. He is the recipient of two National Book Awards and 50 honorary degrees. He was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2006, the nation's highest civil award, for his esteemed contributions to the field of American history. And then there is that commanding voice, the voice that we all learned to love from his years as host of American Experience. While Mr. McCullough often hones his detailed and compelling writing on the great political figures of our country, he takes a different approach in his newest book, The Greater Journey. Here he uses the setting of 19th century Paris to share the stories of the creative Americans, doctors, lawyers, musicians, poets, artists, and dancers, whose adventures abroad subsequently changed American history. As in all of his books, David McCullough transports us to a different time and a different place. The likes of Samuel Morris, John Singer Sargent, Isadora Duncan, and James Fenimore Cooper come to life, as does the Paris of nearly two centuries ago, the city of lights that gave us American artists and innovators, or that gave American artists and innovators the creative space they needed to flourish. Now, all of what I've just told you is true, but it can be read on a book jacket or in a New York Times book review. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about the man behind those exceptional books. As Bill mentioned, for 10 years, I had the privilege of managing a lecture series, a literary organization very similar to the series that you're attending this evening. And as an English major, it was an absolute dream job. I not only had the pleasure of hearing great writers discuss their work, but I also had more personal encounters with them. I got to see them backstage, extending invitations, driving back and forth to the airport, entertaining them at dinner, and showing them the town. Some were demanding. Some were terrified about walking out on stage. Some were actually quite pleasant and funny. All of them were memorable for one reason or another, no one more so than David McCullough. I'm happy to tell you that our guest this evening is not only a great writer and a captivating speaker. Off stage, he is gracious, thoughtful, charming, articulate, and a proud Pennsylvanian, giving generously of his time and his talents to benefit libraries, cultural organizations, and communities. I have no doubt that you will leave the Free Library this evening with two things, a good read for the summer and great admiration for the incomparable David McCullough. Please join me in welcoming him.
Very good. Thank you, Susan, very much, and what a nice greeting. I I love Philadelphia. I've worked here. I've had good times here. And I have come back at every opportunity, but especially when I get to play a part in community support and appreciation for the public library. I believe in libraries with all I believe, all that I feel about one of the most important foundations of our whole way of life. The idea is free to everybody, knowledge, learning, all there. When we walk through the portals of a library, we are walking through the portals of freedom. We are in a contest today with a force in the world that believes in enforced ignorance. We don't. And as present and as important a representation of that is the public library. Our public libraries began here. I love Philadelphia because I love its history. I love the historic buildings. And the favorite building in my mind, the one that means the most to me, is one that many people, many tourists, walk right by, Carpenter's Hall. I love it because it's so small. And to think it all began there, in that one beautiful little building, the First Continental Congress. But also, upstairs is a library, the first library. And just as we have our Library of Congress on the same Acropolis in Washington as our Capitol, so too our first meeting place for Congress had its library there with it. So it's embryonic expression of the whole idea of learning, education, freedom of mind, freedom of thought, with the very foundation of who we are. One of the lessons of our history, and surely one of the lessons of life, is that nothing much of consequence is ever accomplished alone. And you all know that from your own lives. And certainly a book is a perfect metaphor, a perfect example of that. This new book of mine, for example, which I've always been pleased by the production quality of the books that Simon & Schuster has published of mine, and I've never had any other publisher. But the quality of the paper, the design, the reproduction of the color in this book, the presentation of everything about it is so superb, and all done by very talented people, a dozen or more, not to mention all the people that I list in the back of the book in the acknowledgments section, in the more than 32 libraries and institutions from which the material for the book was drawn, or the people who have helped me with research and with the source notes and all of that. So this is a joint effort of a lot of people, and the fact that I get my name up there is really not fair to a large degree. And most important of all, of the people that helped me with the book, is my editor-in-chief, who happens to be here tonight, and who happens also to be my wife, Rosalie. And I'm proud to say that we have 5 children, we have 18 grandchildren, and she's mission control. And she's the best dancer I've ever danced with in my life. She's my polar star, and I would love for you to meet her. Rosalie, would you stand up, please? She's also chair of the Ethics Committee. And this little book that I hold up right now is one of the treasures of your library. It's Galignani's Guide to Paris. This is the little book, and I devote a good deal of time to it in my book because it was so important to all the Americans who went there. This was their Bible. And it was, they carried it everywhere they went. They all had it over years and years and years before Baedeker's became the big thing. It's in English, and it was designed for English tourists, mainly English people, because they were the great tourists of the time. Americans were fairly few and far between. And Galignani's bookstore is still in business in Paris on the Rue de Rivoli. But this was the kind of source that I drew upon. But the main source were the letters and the diaries of the people who went over. And I've been very fortunate in my subjects, and I've enjoyed all the books that I have worked on and undertaken. But I have never had a better time working on a book than this one. I've had an experience like none of the others, because in many ways I was writing about things that have mattered to me since for as long as I can remember, back when I was in school in Pittsburgh. Art, music, theater, ideas, science. History is much more than just politics and the military. And the more I've thought about it, the more I've read about it, the more I feel that we haven't understood that sufficiently, those of us who have taught or write history. And much more should be made of it. I was interested in Paris from the time I think my brother, my oldest brother Hax, came back from Paris, bringing Edith Piaf records and Baudelaire's books and all his wonderful talk about life in Paris. I was in high school by then. And then seeing one of our neighborhood heroes growing up, local boy named Gene Kelly, in the movie The American in Paris. And there he was, a painter. I wanted to be a painter. He was dancing through the streets of Paris, charming all the beautiful girls, and that made a deep impression on me. We saw Paris for the first time, Rosalie and I, in 1961. I had quit my job in New York to go to work for the New Frontier, for the Kennedy administration. I had taken very much to heart the call to serve our country rather than waiting for the country to do something for us. And I was assigned to become an expert on the Arab world, and we were off to Morocco on the beginnings of a long extended tour through all the Arab countries. And we flew all day long by prop plane. Jets hadn't come in yet. And landed at Paris late at night. It was in February. It was pouring rain, pitch dark, about as miserable a night as you could imagine. We took the taxi to our hotel on the left bank, the Hotel de Saint-Pierre on the Rue de Saint-Pierre, little hotel still there, and put our bags in the room and went out and walked for about 2 hours in the dark and the rain, and were so excited, so thrilled, because we were in Paris. But I think that the experience that sort of gelled it for me, and I knew this is what I wanted to do, what happened in Washington one morning when I was driving down Massachusetts Avenue on my way to an appointment with somebody, or rather don't remember what it was. And a guy came to Sheridan Circle where there was a huge traffic jam. And everything stopped. And I looked over to the center of the circle where the equestrian statue of General Phil Sheridan was riding high, and there he was with the requisite pigeon on his head. And it's a fine piece of work of sculpture. It's by Goodson Borglum, who did the faces in Mount Rushmore. And I began to wonder how many people who drive around this circle every day, twice a day, thousands of people, have any idea who that was? Any idea whatsoever? Why is it called Sheridan Circle? And as I was thinking about that, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue began to play on the radio, the car radio. And I love Gershwin, I adore Gershwin, and I was transported by it. And I forgot all about my frustration with the traffic jam and the feelings of the morning. And I thought, isn't this marvelous? Here's a man that's been gone for so long, and yet he's alive right now. He's as present in my life and in the life of anybody else who happens to be listening, as if he were just around the corner somewhere, playing at his piano, composing something new. And I thought, who's more important to us? Who's more essential to being an American or an understanding America? Phil Sheridan or George Gershwin? And the answer, of course, is they're both very important. Very important. But we must not leave out the Gershwins of American life. So thinking about that, thinking about his American in Paris suite, which is my favorite of all, I began to think, let's do Americans in Paris. And I pretty quickly realized I didn't want to do the 18th century Americans, Franklin, Jefferson, Adams, because I'd done it, in my book on Adams. And I didn't want to do the 1920s and 30s, the Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Gertrude Stein time, because I felt it had been done and done and done again. And I also began to think the lost generation, they weren't lost. They knew exactly where they were. They were in Paris. So here was a big gap from 1830 to 1900, 70 years, about a lifetime of that day, about which almost nothing had been done. Nothing. Now, some aspects of the various characters in that period are written about or included in the biographies of those characters. But to look at it as a group, as an American experience, hadn't been done. And that, of course, made it all the more appealing to me. I don't like to write about something that I know a lot about. I've never done that. I wouldn't want to do it. I've never felt that I was an expert on Harry Truman or John Adams or the Brooklyn Bridge. And if I knew all about it, I wouldn't want to write the book, because the pleasure is in the discovery. It's in how much you learn in the process of doing the book. And I've learned so very much from this book and about people that I never heard of before. Now, I had certain criteria. I couldn't include everybody who went to Paris in that period, or it'd become a encyclopedia or a catalog. So I had to pick and choose. And who would I not do? Well, I didn't want to do anybody who just went over to have a good time. I didn't want to do anybody who just went over to make a social splash or to come back and be able to swan around and say, I've been in Paris. And I didn't want to do people who were sent there by their business firm unless something of particular note happened to them because they were in Paris at a crucial moment. What I wanted to write about were the people who went there out of ambition to excel. Not to be rich, not to be famous, not to be powerful, but to excel. To excel in painting, sculpture, music, dance, ideas, invention, and medicine. And who, because they were able to raise their ability or their skill or their knowledge, they brought something back home with them, either figuratively or literally, and that something that they brought home changed us, made life different for us, made the American experience for all of us different than it would have been had they not gone. Now, keep in mind that in the 1830s, we were way behind, not just in appreciation of art or music, way behind in education. There were no schools of architecture, for example. If you wanted to be an architect, you had to go to Europe. You had to go to England or to France, much preferably the École des Beaux-Arts, the greatest architectural school in the world. So Richard Morris Hunt, who was the first American student of architecture to be accepted there, was followed by people like H.H. Richardson, Charles McKim of McKim, Mead & White, Stanford White, spent time in Paris, John Lafarge, Louis Sullivan, on down the list. The look of our country, the look of our buildings, of our, particularly our city, major city buildings, Metropolitan Museum in New York, Richard Morris Hunt, Trinity Church, one of the great landmarks of architecture in the country in Boston, H.H. Richardson, the Boston Public Library across from Trinity Church, Charles McKim, on and on. Louis Sullivan virtually transformed Chicago when Chicago was rebuilt after the fire of 1871. Sculpture, no schools of sculpture here. Augustus St. Gaudens, an immigrant shoemaker's son, street kid from New York, put to work by his father when he was 13 years old, went over and got it, was admitted to the School of Sculpture at the École des Beaux-Arts because he was immensely talented, but he also had a long way to go. He came back and became the greatest American architect of the 19th century, in my view, is the greatest, sculptor, greatest American sculptor of the 19th century, and in my view, the greatest American sculptor ever. And his works are landmarks, not just in American sculpture, but in the interpretation of American history. And then there was another one, who I never heard of. I knew a little bit about St. Gaudens, but not much. I had no idea what a life he lived and what an extraordinary man he was. George P.A. Healy was a name that I didn't know. It's a name that means almost nothing to most people. It's a name that means almost nothing to art historians. George P.A. Healy became the most prominent American portrait painter of his day on both sides of the Atlantic. He painted virtually everybody of consequence on both sides of the Atlantic, including Abraham Lincoln, General Grant, General Sherman, Ferdinand de Lesseps, Louis Philippe, Bismarck, on and on. And there are now 7 Healys hanging in the White House. There are 17 Healys hanging in the National Portrait Gallery. He recorded the faces of history, if you will, as nobody else did. And I want to read to you about how he got started. Now, he, like St. Gaudens, was a boy off the streets of Boston, Irish kid, who could draw. He was very talented. And he knew if he wanted to be anything, because there were no art schools, he had to go to Paris. He went over in steerage, just as St. Gaudens did. And here's what he wrote. Keep in mind, please, too, that he had no education beyond about 7th grade, nor did St. Gaudens. In those far-off days, there were no art schools in America, no drawing classes, no collections of fine plaster casts, and very few picture exhibitions. There were no museums. You couldn't walk down to the museum and go in and see what a great portrait or great landscape looked like. I knew no one in France. I was utterly ignorant of the language. I did not know what I should do when once there, but I was not yet 21, and I had a great stock of courage, and this is the part I love, and of inexperience, which is sometimes a big help, and a strong desire to be my very best. That's the clue to all these people. They're not going over there because they're disenchanted with America. They want to be the best they can be. And they're going against the tide. They're going east instead of west. And they went over in appreciable numbers that became even larger as steam navigation replaced the sailing ship on the North Atlantic. But those who went over in the days of the sailing ship faced a very difficult, unpleasant experience. A long trip. It was no different than it had been when John Adams sailed across. It took at least a month at best. And when they landed in France at Le Havre and started on their way up to Paris and stopped overnight halfway at Rouen and saw the great cathedral at Rouen for the first time, saw a magnificent Gothic masterpiece of Europe, it was an experience such as they never, ever had experienced or would ever forget as long as they lived. And almost without exception, they all wrote about it. It wasn't just that it was so big, and it was very big. They'd never seen a building that large. Now, that's the cathedral Monet painted over and over again in different light. You've seen those, particularly the great doorways. And it towered more than 300 feet higher than the highest building in the United States then, which was the Dome of the Capitol in Washington. And the Dome of the Capitol in Washington was the old dome, not the present one. So it was infinitely bigger. It was all of stone. They'd never seen that. And it had exposed sculpture on the exterior of the building. And they'd never seen that. But what, and they had never seen a great Catholic shrine. And most all of them were Protestants. And when they saw this magnificent building, there was no cheap scorn or wisecracks about it being a Catholic shrine that I have ever seen or even found hints of. They were smitten by it. They were some of them speechless by it. But part of that was how old it was. Now keep in mind that so old and historic a building as Independence Hall was less than 100 years old in 1832 or whatever. This building had been started early in the 13th century. It was older. It had been built before Columbus sailed. And this really rocked them, that suddenly the old world was the new world. Suddenly they felt what Charles Sumner called the prestige of age. And it's what many people feel when they come to this great city as tourists and visit Independence Hall, the prestige of the age of that structure, the age of our country. And it's, of course, nothing compared to Europe. So as great as the adventure, the journey had been over the sea, a greater journey had begun once they got to Rouen and realized what was in store for them. And when they got to Paris, of course, Notre Dame was older still. The Pont Neuf, meaning the new bridge, which is, of course, still there. The new bridge was started in 1604, and it was called the New Bridge. This was more than they could take. And it changed them. The whole experience changed them. They first impulse was to get out and walk. Still is. Much of what they felt is exactly what most of us have felt the first time we were ever in Paris. And they found that Paris was a place where you needed to walk, but also was a place where you wanted to walk. And they couldn't get over what they saw. They couldn't get over the fact, for example, that people were so nice to them, so courteous. And nobody spoke English. Everything was in French, all the signs, the money. Nobody spoke English. And they didn't speak French because modern European languages weren't yet taught in Paris, in the United States. So they have to learn the new language. They're plunged into an ancient culture, a totally different culture, and they can't speak a word of it. Now imagine being a medical student and arriving at the École de Médecine to study with thousands of medical students there. And you can't understand a word. You're making the rounds with the doctors. You're going to demonstrations in one of the great amphitheaters. We hope maybe 1,000 students watching. And you don't understand the language. Well, what they had to do, of course, was cram. They had to hire tutors and learn as fast as they could. And they caught on, most of them. Some, as is always the case, some caught on very quickly. Some had a very difficult time with it. Oliver Wendell Holmes, senior medical student, caught on immediately. Others did not catch on so fast. The key to understanding this, it seems to me, is to remember, which is hard to imagine, that all foreign students, meaning all Americans, could attend the Sorbonne, the greatest university in the world, or the École de Médecine, the medical school, greatest medical school in the world. Paris was the medical capital of the world. They could attend those classes, those lectures, for free. Now imagine if Harvard or Princeton or the University of Pennsylvania, it was free for any foreign student that wanted to come there. Also, all they had to pay was their transportation over and back, if they went back, and they had to pay for their room and board. And they all were writing letters. They had to write letters. Writing letters was part of life. And, of course, particularly when you're away from home and your parents are worried about you, and for good reason, worried about disease, worried about falling into sinful ways among those decadent French people, and very worried about it. And these, many of the young men, women, brought up in a strict Calvinist tradition. Holmes would write letters back to his parents explaining that it was all right, mother and father, if I go to the theater. You don't have to tear this part of the letter off when you show it to your friends. And they're writing back also to say how they're progressing with their work or their studies. And since many of the medical students were the sons of medical students, the fathers wanted to know what's the latest thing. You know, how are they performing this sort of an operation, or how are they treating that particular disease? Keep in mind that American medicine was woefully behind, way behind. Most American doctors had never been to medical school. They trained under some other doctor who'd never been to medical school. What medical schools there were inadequate, tiny, and suffered from, as all American training in medicine did, from two very serious social stigmas, not roadblocks in the way of science or technology, but social mores. One was that most American women, the vast majority of American women, would have preferred to die than to allow a man to examine their body. And since all doctors were men, alas, thousands of American women died. Terrible, useless, senseless. The other one was that there was a great sort of moral objection on moral or social grounds that cutting up dead bodies, the use of cadavers, was not acceptable. And in many states, it was illegal. So what that meant was that if they needed to dissect bodies to teach medicine or to practice their medical art, they had to buy them on the black market. They had to buy what was supplied by grave robbers. And consequently, a cadaver was extremely expensive. And consequently, most American medical students never dissected an arm or a leg until they were doing it to a living arm or leg. And before ether was invented, they were doing it on a living arm or leg that belonged to somebody who was suffering the whole experience without the benefit of an anesthetic. Almost unimaginable. In Paris, no stigma among women about a man examining their body, so these students could make the rounds examining both male and female patients. And no stigma about the use of cadavers. Cadavers were plentiful, and they spent hours and hours and hours in the dissecting auditorium, and it was a big part of their education. Holmes, Oliver Wendell Holmes, said that they could learn in 2 years what would take at least 10 more years or more at home in general practice to have learned. 2 years in Paris would do it. And Holmes came back, talking about bringing somebody home, Holmes came back to Harvard to spend the next 36 years teaching anatomy in the Harvard Medical School. Holmes was a very great poet, known as a poet then. He was an essayist. His Autocrat at the Breakfast Table is still one of the classics in American essays. And he was the founder of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. And he saw no incongruity about that, no contradiction, any more than Samuel F. B. Morse went over as a painter and saw no contradiction in having the idea while he was there of something called the telegraph and inventing the telegraph and bringing that back with him, as well as one of the masterpieces of that time, his Gallery of the Louvre, and a great interior of the Louvre, which no American had ever attempted before, a huge 6-by-9-foot canvas that, by the way, will be on exhibit this summer at the National Gallery in Washington, if you happen to be there, because it's usually in storage. I want to read you a couple of things by some Philadelphians. Philadelphians play a big part in my book. They include some of the better known or more obvious Philadelphians, like Henry Tanner, one of the earliest and most gifted African-American painters, who went to Paris to study, as did others. Thomas Aikens, who went to Paris to study, Mary Cassatt, Fitzwilliam and Mary Singer Sargent, the parents of John Singer Sargent, who are another kind of story of Americans in Paris, and a man named John Sanderson, who was a teacher from here, and who wrote a little book called The American in Paris that was published in the 1840s, and in my mind is one of the best books about Paris ever written by an American. And here's one of the his observations. The French dine to gratify, we to appease appetite. We demolish dinner, they eat it. And then he was hugely moved by parks and the need for parks in America. And it's very vivid and right. And we forget there were no parks much in America, city parks. He kept thinking how much city life at home could be improved by public spaces of such beauty. He was sitting in the Garden of the Tuileries. At home, the value of city property was reckoned almost exclusively by what could be built on it. Independence Square, he had heard Philadelphians calculate, was worth $1,000 a foot, every inch of it. Pride in new railroads and the like too often led Americans to measure value by the capacity to answer some practical physical need. Utility, with all her arithmetic, very often miscalculates, he wrote. Let us have gardens, then, and other public places where we may see our friends and parade our vanities, if you will, before the eyes of the world. Did you ever know anyone who was not delighted with a garden? I think of that so often whenever I walk through a beautiful garden in one of our American cities. And it took that kind of attitude, as it took the attitude coming back by people who'd seen an opera for the first time in their life, who'd seen a great ballerina dance, and who'd been with audiences who knew a good performance from a fair performance to a punk performance. And some of these people suddenly realized that the reason the theater in Paris was so superb, that the actors were so superb, is that they had to live up to the expectations of the audience. And that we forget that when we start canceling art or music or the theater in our school system. It's not just that we're going to fail to develop the people that we really want to have, exerting the best of their abilities and making the most of themselves from what they've learned in our school systems, but we're going to lose our audience. We're going to lose people who have the judgment, the taste, the appreciation to respond to excellence when it's there in front of us. I want to just quickly tell you something about Charles Sumner. Like General Sheridan, Sumner has a statue in the Public Garden in Boston. I doubt there's one Bostonian in 1,000 who has any idea who he was. When Charles Sumner died in 1874, the whole city, at the day of his funeral, the whole city shut down in mourning. The whole city stopped. When his body was taken from the State House on Beacon Hill to Mount Auburn Cemetery, which is 5 miles away, the whole road, all the way out on both sides, was lined with mourners. And yet now nobody knows him. Charles Sumner went over to Paris to take classes, sitting in lectures at the Sorbonne. He'd graduated from Harvard. He graduated from the Harvard Law School. And he decided after 2 or 3 years of opening his own law practice, he didn't know enough. He wasn't sufficiently educated. His cultural level was too low. So he heard that you could go to the Sorbonne for nothing. He borrowed several $1,000 from some of his friends, and he went over. And while he was attending the Sorbonne one day, which he wrote in his journal, and again I stress that all these observations, all this material that I'm drawing upon about these people is all taken from the real thing. If they didn't write about what happened to them in Paris, I didn't include them because I didn't want to be winging it. I didn't want to be hypothesizing. And if they weren't changed by it. Winslow Homer, for example, went to Paris, and Aikens too, I think, to a large degree. And they were not greatly changed by it. They were already pretty well formed as painters. Sumner was deeply changed by it because one day he was watching the other students and noticing that the black students in the lecture hall had the same way of moving about, dressed the same way, talked the same way, were treated like everybody else. They treated everybody else like everybody else, and they had the same aspirations as everybody else. And he wrote in his journal, "I wonder if the way we treat black people at home has more to do with what we've been taught and is not part of the natural order of things." It was an epiphany for him. It changed him, because we know he didn't have any particular sympathy for black people or black people that he'd seen working as slaves in the fields of Maryland on a railroad ride through on his way to Washington. No sympathy whatever. Said that they probably were, that's all they were good for. But this changed him profoundly. He came home, got into politics, got elected to the United States Senate when he was in his early 40s, and became the most powerful voice for abolition in the United States Senate. So outspoken, so strident, that it nearly cost him his life. He's the one, you may remember, who was attacked from behind by a Southern congressman and nearly beaten to death with a heavy walking stick. A stunning, appalling event on the floor of the Senate, in the old Senate. You can go there, you can see his desk, you see exactly how Preston Brooks, the man who attacked him, came from behind, did it. He never recovered, either physically or psychologically, but he never gave up on the abolitionist movement and became Lincoln's strongest supporter in the Senate. Now, he goes to Paris. He has this sudden realization. He comes back, applies it to his life politically, is attacked for it. And when John Brown and his people heard about the attack out in Kansas City, it was that news that caused them to commit what's known as the Pottawatomie Massacre, when they descended on some very innocent people and slaughtered them in retribution for what had happened to Sumner. And that, of course, sparked outrage of all kinds, which just fed more to the furnace of war that was brewing. I can't tell you how much I admire many of these people. They were not disenchanted with their country. They loved their country, and they wanted to bring something back. It wasn't just for their own benefit, but for the benefit of their country. And they all did. And the majority of them all came back and became teachers to teach what they had been taught in Paris. The medical students did it. The art students did it. And with great effect. And many of the people who went over and came back with ideas, like John Sanderson, who was a teacher. And there's nobody more important in our society, nor has there ever been anybody more important in our society than our teachers. And you know that, and nobody's efforts count more in the long run than our teachers. Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who was one of the greatest teachers ever in the whole American story, retired from his long career at the Harvard Medical School by delivering a farewell address. Now, here was a man who was a poet, essayist, friend of everybody, who was celebrated in Europe and one of the most famous Americans of the day. And when I think of what he might have talked about in that farewell address, and then I found out he talked about the teacher he had had at the École de Médecine, Dr. Louis, who had the greatest influence on the medical students of anybody. And the fact that Louis was born to be a teacher, and he taught them the love of the truth. And how often of late I have wondered, how well are we teaching the love of the truth? Now, without resorting to preaching, let me just say that these people, to my mind, the best of them, were the living examples of the best that education can produce. And with very few exceptions. Now, I want to cut now, and if they start to put the lights down, I want to show you some images that I hope will bring some of this to life for you a little more. These are all drawn from the book. They're photographs, paintings, engravings. And again, let me stress, these all were real people who came from a variety of backgrounds, who didn't know then that they were going to be the greatest sculptor or the greatest teacher of medicine or write the brilliant novel or design the great work of American architecture. There we go. This is the Rue de Rivoli, and I'm going to come out here so I can work this thing, I hope. There we go. This is the Louvre on the right. This is the fence around the Garden of the Tuileries. This is the arcade. It's all just the same today. If you were to take those horses and wagons away and replace them with automobiles, it would look just the same. Is the image in focus for everybody?
Yes.
I must tell you, this image is a photograph, obviously, and it's a photograph taken. It's really a reproduction of a postcard that we found in our attic at home, because it was brought back in 1907 from Paris in a collection that my mother had, because she'd gone there with her parents when she was seven in 1907. So this is part of the author's collection, as they say. This is Emma Willard. Emma Willard was the first American woman to champion higher education for women, and she wrote one of the most deeply felt of all the responses to the cathedral at Rouen here on the right. And her journals and her letters are brilliant. And she was a teacher who went in order to come home to do a better job of teaching, and she brought back with her a young woman to teach French at the Emma Willard School, which was an innovation. This is the great painting, The Gallery of the Louvre, by Samuel F.B. Morse, and it includes the masterpieces that he felt mattered most and that Americans ought to see. Keep in mind, they can't go to a museum to see any works of art. They can't look at color reproductions. So he's going to bring these home to raise the level of appreciation among his fellow Americans, in much exactly the same spirit as Jefferson came home with 86 crates of books from Paris and paintings from Paris, for the same very idea. This is the great Grand Gallery of the Louvre, the longest room in the world, which is more than a quarter of a mile long. And this is the Salon Carré. But he's rehung it with those paintings from the collection that he thought were most important. This is Francis I, who began the Louvre collection, and includes, of course, Mona Lisa down here, Veronese's Wedding at Cana, and Titian, Rembrandt, they're all there. There's a key to the painting, which will be included when it is on exhibit this summer at the National Gallery, which tells you all about each painting. But what it doesn't tell you is who the people are. This is Samuel Morse himself at the front. And again, you see he's showing himself teaching, instructing this young woman art student. And he is a young woman art student because in France, women were just as much taken just as seriously as art students as men were. And he wanted that idea to come home. It's another young woman doing a miniature. And over here in the corner is his friend, James Fenimore Cooper, the great novelist who was in Paris with him, and Mrs. Cooper, his wife, and their daughter, Susan, with whom it was thought Morse was having a love affair. Morse was a widower. Whether it's true or not, impossible to say. This man over here is another young American painter who was Morse's roommate. And in here, coming through the door, is the American sculptor Horatio Greeno. Now, nothing is in a painting by accident. I try to tell students that. Don't think about everything that's included in a painting is the result of a choice. But also everything that's not in the painting is the result of a choice. And what's so interesting is who's not in this painting. Most of these people, over half the people in the painting, this is supposed to be a typical scene at the Louvre, are Americans. In fact, Americans would be very few and far between. There are no soldiers, no priests, no aristocrats, no French bourgeois. Morse is saying something with that. Exactly what he's saying, you'll have to read the book to get that thing. The painting is also hiding a huge reality. And none of the art historians that I have read or know about have ever mentioned this. But at the very time that this was going on, when he was painting this huge, and he had to go way up high here. These paintings were all over the museum, but these are about 10 to 12 feet high. He had to build a special scaffold to get up to paint them. So here's this American character on a movable scaffold that he can wheel around through the whole museum, up there painting on this giant canvas. And every single day, his friend Cooper came to keep him company, because Cooper liked to write in the morning and come over and visit with Morse in the afternoon. But what happened was that this painting was being done right in the midst of the worst cholera epidemic in the history of Europe and Paris. People were dying in the streets right outside these walls, literally. 18,000 people died in less than 6 months, just in Paris. It was horrific. And Morse was writing home to his brother saying, I go to sleep every night wondering if I'm going to die in the night and I'll never finish the painting. Now, Cooper, almost all the Americans had left town. But Cooper didn't leave because his wife was too ill to move. And Morse didn't leave because he was running out of money and he was determined to finish his work before the museum closed for the summer in August. So Cooper came to keep Morse's morale up. And under, you can imagine the duress. It's terrifying. And I know a very few examples of a friendship under stress, of a friend in need being a friend in need, that would equal that. And much about the book has to do with friendships, the medical students, Morse and Cooper. Because, as you know, when you're abroad and you're with other Americans abroad, somehow friendships that you form there are like nothing else. There's a bond that's stronger, different. There's an old saying, too, that when you're abroad and traveling abroad, the country you learn the most about is your own. And this was very true of these people. They are getting a great education about their country, seeing it from a perspective they never had experienced before. This is George Healy, one of many self-portraits that he did when he didn't have a commission. He painted himself over and over again. Sort of the way he stayed in shape. He was a terrific man with a wonderful family, a great sense of humor, great talker. People loved to sit for him because he was so entertaining in what he said. And he spent much of his time in Paris, much of his life in Paris. This is his great portrayal of Webster's reply to Hayne. There's Webster there speaking in the Congress. And all these people in the Congress are the real faces and done either from life studies that Healy did or from photographs. And that painting, which is bigger even than Morse's Gallery of the Louvre, hangs very much as it hangs right here on this stage as the backdrop at Faneuil Hall, one of the two or three most important historic destinations in our country, Faneuil Hall in Boston. This is Oliver Wendell Holmes over here, and on the left, and this is the dissecting amphitheater, right there. Now, I want to read you something said about this, and this will be a little rough, but you got to take it. Is there any way you can turn the light on here, please, for me, on the stage, just so I can have the light for a minute to read this? Thank you. This was written by a Philadelphia surgeon named Augustus Gardner, who went to Paris to see what was happening with these students and their whole way of life. He wrote a book about it, a marvelous book. And here's what he wrote. Here the assiduous student may be seen, this is in the, is in the, where 600 students could practice operations on the stone-floored amphitheater for dissecting. Here the assiduous students may be seen with his soiled blouse and his head bedecked with a fantastic cap. In one hand he holds a scalpel, in the other a treatise on anatomy. He carries in his mouth a cigar whose intoxicating fumes, so hurtful on most occasions, render him insensible to the smell of 20 bodies decomposing, putrefying around him. Here, too, is the learned professor who thus prepares himself for a difficult operation by refreshing his anatomy and thus rehearses his part in the tragedy to be acted on the morrow. The blood and pieces of flesh upon the floor he regards as the sculptor does the fragments of marble lying around the unfinished statue. For all that was so morbidly unpleasant about the work at the dissecting tables, the stench, the smoke, it was far better, every student came to appreciate, that they practice on the dead than on the living. If the work was laborious, they had chosen a laborious profession. For any of the Americans to have given up and gone home would have been easy enough, but there is no evidence that any of them did. They would not quit. They did not quit. And to the benefit of American medicine and their patients, when they return. You can take that down now, please. John Sanderson, as a young man, about the time that he went over, very handsome, tall, 6'2", magnificent voice. He would memorize a speech that was 50 pages in length on paper and memorize the whole thing before delivering it. George Catlin was a lawyer here in Philadelphia, who thought maybe he might become a painter. He saw some American Indians come through town in their full regalia and realized, as he said, that his future had just entered his life. He knew exactly what he wanted to do for the rest of his life, and he set out for the Great Plains, where he painted the Plains Indians as nobody ever had. And he took 500 of his paintings to Europe, and when he and his paintings and a band of Iowa Indians who were traveling with him appeared in Paris, they took the city by storm. The people went crazy. No American artist was ever welcomed with such enthusiasm or caused such a stir. And here they are performing their war dances in the Palace of the Tuileries before King Louis-Philippe and his family. And the other great sensation of the time was Tom Thumb on the right with his manager, the great P.T. Barnum. Tom Thumb, Tom Pouce, they called him, also was the rage in Paris. Cafes and bars, they changed their names to Tom Pouce. And he would ride up and down the Champs-Élysées in a tiny little carriage with tiny little footmen and tiny little ponies pulling. And they went wild. They went wild. This is Harriet Beecher Stowe on the right. Harriet Beecher Stowe came to get away from the adulation of the crowds because her Uncle Tom's Cabin had just been published in English, and she was a sensation both in the United States and England, to the point where she really was undone by it. Her book had yet to be published in French, so she went to Paris and was treated like just any other little American lady of no importance, and she loved it. And she went to the Louvre and sat there for by the hour studying one painting at a time and writing superbly about what she felt and saw. She was not an art historian, but she was a very perceptive, deep-thinking woman. This on the left is Elihu Washburn, our minister to France at the time of the Franco-Prussian War. This is the scene of Paris burning. This is during the siege of Paris and during the Commune afterward, which is even more horrible than the siege, when French were killing French and the Communards, as they were known, tried to burn the city down and very nearly succeeded. They wanted to burn the Louvre. They did burn the Hotel de Ville. And Washburn, of his own choice, stayed through the entire siege when the Germans had Paris surrounded and were starving it into surrender. An awful time where everybody was starving, eating anything they could get their hands on. And it went on for 5 months. He stayed through all of it and stayed through the Commune, as it's known, and even more hideous convulsion of human depravity and cruelty, and one of the worst episodes in human history of pure savagery and ugliness. And he stayed of choice, out of a sense of duty, he felt, because there were some Americans still there, and he couldn't walk away as long as there were Americans there. Every other diplomat for every other major power left town immediately, got out, but he stayed. And to his huge credit, he kept a diary through it all, every single day, superbly written, full of detail, full of emotion, full of insight. And that diary, until just a year or two ago, was largely unknown. And it turned up, of all places, in the Library of Congress. They didn't even know they had it. It was a letterpress copy of the pages of a diary that had been bound in with other letters and so was indistinguishable from the other letters until Mike Hill, who works with me on research, figured out the puzzle. And then, of course, if that was the letterpress, where was the original? And the original was in Livermore, Maine, which is the little town up in western Maine on the New Hampshire line where Mr. Washburn came from. And he was one of a remarkable family, 10 children, 4 boys, 4 sons, all of whom served in Congress, all at the same time. It never happened before, it's never happened since. All from a different state, all got reelected. All were ardent supporters of Abraham Lincoln. And Washburn, who came from Illinois, Galena, Illinois, is the one that kept pressing Lincoln to put Grant in command. Grant was his neighbor in Galena. Washburn knew Grant, knew what he was made of and what he had he could contribute. And these stories are so remarkable because they had nothing. They were the boys were hired out when they were 12 years old as farmhands because the family could not afford to feed them at home. And yet the mother, who had no education, kept saying, if you get an education, there is no limit to where you can go. And much of this remarkable man's education came from public libraries, by going to the library. And she was once asked, why is it that all your sons leave Maine? She said, oh, there's no state in the Union big enough to hold any of my children. Mary Cassatt on the left, John Singer Sargent with his famous, infamous at the time, painting of Madame X, as he called it. Oh, wait a minute, sorry. Over on the right. Sargent painted this one and the wonderful painting of the daughters of Edward Boit, very mysterious painting of some little girls with giant Japanese vases, an interior, and his magnificent El Jaleo, the painting of the flamenco dancer in Madrid, supposedly set in Madrid. He painted all three of those masterpieces, all of which were here in the United States, when he was still in his 20s. And he's a very interesting story because he among all these American characters of note, he had the most talent. I don't think there's any question about it. He was just brilliant from the start. But he had been born in Europe because his parents, who came from Philadelphia, his father was a physician here who walked away from his practice at age 32, very promising physician. And his wife, Mary Singer Sargent, had some money. And the money began to go less far. And in order to keep up appearances, principally, they went to Europe and lived there because they couldn't stand what they felt would be the shame of being in Philadelphia with dwindling resources and therefore having to lower their way of life in front of their friends and so forth. And Fitzwilliam Sargent, the father, longed to come home. He was desperately homesick. He hated living in Europe. They were captives, in a sense. They were self-imposed exiles. She, Mrs. Sargent, Barbara Singer, Mary Singer Sargent, loved Europe, loved the conversation of Paris, loved the romance and the culture of all the places. And they kept moving from place to place two or three times in a year, always to find the less expensive place to live. They were living on her money, and so what she wanted was what counted. And they were living on $700 a year and living as though they were well-to-do people and very cultivated people. But in effect, they were Americans without a country. And when, for Fitzwilliam, they realized they had this miraculous son, that really saved Fitzwilliam's life. And Sargent's portrait of his father is heartbreaking, because you look at it and it looks like a study in sadness, a study in depression. It's a very powerful human story. This is the Statue of Liberty, Bertoldi's great work, as it rose out of the back streets of Paris. They built the whole thing before then taking it down, crating up the different parts and shipping them to New York. So you can imagine what an attraction that was, not just for tourists, but for everyone in Paris to see this huge work of sculpture, France's gift to America, rising above the city. Thomas Edison on the right. Edison came to the great World's Fair of 1889 in Paris, the fair that created the Eiffel Tower, and he was a sensation because of his invention of the light bulb, and the city of light was never so spectacularly lighted as after the advent of the light bulb. And he was mobbed. He was the rock star of the fair, and he didn't like it at all. So he hid out with a friend of his, an American painter, in the painter's studio, and the painter took advantage of the opportunity to do Edison's portrait. And this portrait now hangs in the National Portrait Gallery. This is Augustus St. Gaudens on the left, and in a wonderful painting in the Metropolitan in New York by Cox. This is his wife, Gussie, as she was known, down here, in a portrait by Thomas Dewing. And this is one of Gussie's paintings. She was an artist of their interior of their apartment in the Louvre, on the left bank. And that apartment building is still there. His studio was about a 20-minute walk through the Luxembourg Garden on the other side. And over here is the great statue, his first major piece done in Paris, when they were living in Paris, of Admiral Farragut, which stands in Madison Square in New York. Spectacular piece of sculpture commemorating Farragut of Mobile Bay fame, damn the torpedoes, Farragut, and easily as commanding a single figure done by an American ever until then, and the first commemorative piece to the Civil War in the city of New York. In the background is the tower of the old Madison Square Garden, long gone, and atop was St. Gaudens' brilliant rendition of Diana, which the tower was taken down, she was saved, and she now is the great centerpiece at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. All of these came back from Paris, you see. Now, Gussie was a very interesting woman, very interesting story, because she was severely afflicted with deafness and was really shut off from much of life because of it, and particularly when they were living in Paris. Here she was, an American bride in Paris who couldn't speak French and couldn't hear much. But, again, like Washburn, she made a record of her experience. She wrote over 200 letters, which are all in the Dartmouth Library, and a great, great insight into the life of the times and all these Americans like Stanford White and Charles McKim and John Lafarge and the rest that were coming through. Sargent already dropping in, Whistler coming by to visit with Sargent and so forth. I want to, one more, this is the final piece I want to show. This is St. Gaudens' great equestrian statue. I think it's the greatest equestrian statue in our country. It's at 59th and 5th Avenue in New York, right by the entrance to Central Park, just across from the Plaza Hotel. And it's a gilded piece. It's huge. It's 13 feet high. It's atop of a pedestal. It's 11 feet high. And what really makes it, and St. Gaudens certainly felt it made it, was his figure of victory. It's Sherman being led by the goddess of victory. Now, Sherman posed for St. Gaudens 12 times for a study, for a bust, for the head. And that bust is available to be seen in several different places. And you can see it when you're standing on the street level looking up, but not as well as you ought to be able, because the face is horrible. It's the face, it's pockmarked and whiskered and cruel. It's the face of a madman. Truly, it's an insane face. And remember, Sherman is the one who said, war is hell. War is all moonshine. He has looked into the face of hell, and hence looks like it in his expression. Victory is not, her face is not one of glory and hurrah, hurrah, aren't we terrific, we've won. It is, she looks dazed, she looks stunned, like as if she too has looked into the face of hell. And St. Gaudens is much more subtle than most people realize. And so it's a major American work. And like so many works of sculpture in this country, I just was in Chicago recently looking at St. Gaudens's great figure of Lincoln in Lincoln Park. It doesn't tell you who did it. It doesn't tell you this is by Augustus St. Gaudens. And of course it should. And we should know who he was and what he stood for. One last point about this picture. This beautiful woman, as almost no one knows, was an African American. Her name was Hetty Anderson. She came from South Carolina. Now, whether St. Gaudens chose her because of its obvious symbolic importance, we don't know. We do know that he felt that she made the work work. She was essential to it. And he said that she was the most beautiful model that had ever posed for him. But I think it gives us much greater feeling for the piece when we know she was an African American. And that's the cover of my book, and that's my talk. Thank you. Thank you very much. I've gone way, way over the limit, and I don't apologize one iota. Anyone who stands up in this role that I'm in knows when the audience is with him, and you certainly were tonight, and I got my energy and got my excitement from you, believe me. Now, I don't want to stretch my luck, but if you do have a few questions, let's try a few. Yes, sir, right there.
Are you working on a new book?
No, I'm not. No, I'm not. Perfectly good question, but I want to... I feel like I've just climbed the Matterhorn, and I don't want to think about climbing another mountain for a while. Yeah. I don't know. I have a number of ideas. I've got to mull it over. Yes, right here.
Not London, not Rome.
You don't need a mic.
Not London, not Rome, not Vienna, Paris. What about those other great cities? Do they pale in comparison to Paris in the time?
You're singing my song. Yeah, no, I would be very tempted. Italy is very important for the American experience. But I honestly don't know what the next book will be. I think that something's got to be done about how we're teaching our children history, and that's very much on my mind. As I'm sure you saw, there was just a big report with very bad news in that respect. It was published about 2 days ago. And I know from all the lecturing I've done in colleges and universities for 20 years, all over the country, These very bright, very attractive, very appealing young people are woefully ignorant in the story of their country. They are. We've been raising for about two generations young Americans who are by and large historically illiterate. And sometimes it's hilarious what they don't know, where I should say you laugh, because if you didn't, you'd cry. And it's not their faults. It's not their faults. It's our faults, all of us. Truly. It's not the teacher's faults. Partly the teacher's fault, but not all. We've got to do more. We as parents and grandparents have got to do more. We've got to talk about history with them. We've got to talk about the books that we loved when we were their age or younger, or that we're reading right now. We've got to take them to historic places. We've got to go with them, talk about what it means to us, why we care about it. We've got to start talking about things other than sports and television. And bring back dinner. Bring back the dinner table. And teach them to ask questions. They're so schooled in answering questions that they never ask questions. And I keep trying to stress to them, it's how you learn something is to ask questions. And that there's no one that you'll ever meet who doesn't know something that you don't know. Listen to them. Ask them questions.